The Church of God, the Eternal, presents The Test Formula, a message by Mr. Robert Burke, for the morning service of the Feast of Trumpets, September 16th, 2023.
Good morning, brethren. Today is the Feast of Trumpets 2023. And as we rehearse God's plan of salvation through the holy days, we know that today represents the return of Jesus Christ, when he is going to come back and usher in the millennial reign and restore all things back to the way that God intended them to be. And really, what a blessing it is for us to be assembled together at designated places in God's presence, but to be able to do it with peace and security and not have an issue just to get here. There's no persecution, there's no problems, there's no trials, relatively speaking, from the outside world. We might have our own personal challenges and issues, but in terms of assembling in the way that God has commanded us to do, we don't have obstacles right now. And that is a blessing, and we need to be aware of that because things will change in the future. So what God is doing is allowing time for us right now to learn, to grow, to strengthen in belief and love and faith towards him. And he's given us instructions on what to do and how to do that. Principally, we have the Bible, right? Because the Bible is our instruction manual. And recorded in the pages of the Bible is everything that we need to know in order to have a happy life, to have good character, as well as qualify to become a member of the God family. The books of the Bible give us specific instructions. Recall the various Psalms, how to praise God, when to praise God, how to reach out to him in certain circumstances. The book of Proverbs, the wisdom of how to live life and handle different situations are there. What do we do? What do we not do? God has given us those directions in select Proverbs. The book of Galatians will have very specific traits in chapter 5 about traits of the Holy Spirit versus traits of the carnal mind. What should we become and what should we remove? They're very specific items to say do this and don't do that. And we want to use this information because we know that it'll help us become a member of the God family. And I know that's what we all want. But often we don't follow the rules, do we? We don't follow what's written in the instruction manual, and neither did people in the past. And it's because of our human nature that takes over, and we do what we want to do according to our own nature. And when we read the Bible, it really becomes clear that so much of what is recorded is about the failure of people. And some might even say that it's quite a negative book because it's full of stories of people and nations and their rebellion to God and just going after their lusts and desires and whatever that happened to be. And that was in direct opposition to what God commanded. They knew what he commanded, but they chose to do something else. So from Genesis describing the first family to the times of the prophets of Israel, the Bible records a story of repeated failure, right? And we don't read too much about successes, although there are a lot of successes scattered through, but we sure do read a lot about the failures, don't we? We can look back at Cain. Didn't take too long and the first murder took place. Well, people sinned so much that God flooded the entire world. We read about Sodom and Gomorrah and the filth and depravity of what took place in that society that God chose just to completely wipe them out. Israel murmured in the wilderness because they didn't have faith. Israel continued to rebel, so they were subject to 70 years of captivity by the Babylonians. And all throughout, when God was sending his prophets to give him more instructions of what he wanted to do, Israel killed them all. And all of that is recorded in the Bible. But God didn't design the Bible to be written in a manner just to tell us specifically what to do and not do only. Kind of like a checklist. Do this and don't do that. That's all you need to know. Those things are there and do instruct us on so many things. We take a look at the Ten Commandments, the 10 major rules of what to do for love towards God and what to do for love towards man. Those are very explicit, and we understand what those are. The statutes and judgments that are laid out give even more precise application to the Ten Commandments, what to do and what not to do. For example, clean and unclean foods. What is in that category versus what is in the other category? In select Psalms and Proverbs, there are very specific items of what we should be doing and what we should be avoiding. But if we only live like robots or followed commands like a computer, then just giving us a simple to-do list would be sufficient. But the thing is, we're not like that. God gave us a mind that can think and reason and make choices, which also means God's given us the ability and the opportunity to make good choices as well as bad choices. And we seem to do that in our everyday lives. We know that, and that's part of our daily reflection and the reflection we'll do at Passover. What do we do properly and what do we do incorrectly? And we've seen that all through history as well, too. People making good choices and people making bad choices. But a lot of what the Bible is, if we think about it this way, it's a people story. We read about people and their lives. We see the rules were given to them, kind of the checklist of what to do or what not to do. But the story describing really is what they did with that checklist. How did they live their lives, and what did they do, and how did they react? Very importantly, included in the stories is the underlying reasons of why the people did what they did. And that is why the Bible, and specifically ancient Israel, is an example to us. The stories show us, yes, that they sinned and they were not faithful to God, but also the sins that they had, it explains the reasons for them sinning. And those reasons are the same reasons we sin and are not faithful to God. So these stories, these people stories in the Bible, teach us the motives for actions, or the thinking and the desire. And that's what we want to know, right? If we are to reduce our own sins, not just a simple command, do this or don't do that, like a robot, but get to the root of why did they do this versus that? Why did they follow the law? Why did they disobey the law? Because there was a root desire or impulse that they followed, physically or emotionally, and we want to get to that core root so we don't repeat and do the same thing. And there are many reasons for using stories as our teaching guide, but today I want to talk about one of them, and I'm going to call it the test formula. The test formula. So when you look at God's dealing with mankind, he's consistently followed a formula to determine if the people would stay faithful to him and his law, or if they change by accepting a perversion of this law that he gave, or just disregard it completely. And that is illustrated in the stories. And the process has been consistent from the very beginning. And the point that we should take away today is if this process continues as it has from the beginning all throughout recorded history, and it might happen in the future. So we need to be prepared and be aware of some of the possibilities of things we will encounter in the future as God unfolds his plan getting closer to the return of Jesus Christ. And here's the reason. So that we're successful in remaining faithful and not be deceived by something or do something that's going to cause us to stray away from God due to a lack of love for his truth, lack of not understanding something, but something that will cause us to not qualify to be part of his kingdom. So this is what I'll call the test formula, and there's four parts. They're very basic. Part number one, the law or the truth is given. Point number two, it is heard and understood by the people. Point number three, a false alternative is then presented. And number four, after that false alternative is presented, a choice has to be made. And it's a choice to keep what God taught precisely or change it and modify it in some way. And usually that modification is rooted in some sort of temptation or emotional pull, which is why we struggle with sometimes following the rules. But that is what we have to follow and be aware of. And as God uses this formula, he may allow events to take place over a short period of time or a long period of time before step number four is reached. At each of the steps, signs and wonders might be used. They're not always used, but throughout the Bible, we do read of them, and they can either be used in one or two different ways. Number one, to substantiate God's truth in his servants, or number two, to test the people in their faithfulness. And this is really important because it's been used in the past and it will be used in the future. The root of it all, though, whether it's number one or number two, substantiating God's truth in the servants or a test to the people, it all comes down to the faith once delivered. Right? Something you've heard for years and even decades, it all comes down to the faith once delivered. Do you know it and do you believe it? And will you hold on to it no matter what? And that's the key. Because it's not what you see, per se, that might have an impact. But regardless of what you see, it has to be rooted and substantiate what you were taught from the beginning based on revelation. Okay, so let's start with the very beginning of humanity with Adam and Eve and walk through this formula, and we'll see how it applies. So number one, the law or the truth is given. Well, we know that to be true because God spoke to them and he taught them his law. He completely set them up for success, gave them all the information that they needed at that time. So that was fulfilled. Number two, Adam and Eve heard it and understood it. So whatever God told them, they heard it, they understood it, they knew right from wrong. They knew what God said they were supposed to do, and they also knew what God said they were not supposed to do. They were not confused in any way. So point number two is accomplished. Then point number three, a false alternative was presented. And we'll turn to Genesis chapter 3, and we'll read verses 1 through 5. Just to repeat the story of Satan's influence and his deception. So Genesis chapter 3 and read verses 1 through 5. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the eternal God had made. And he said unto the woman, yea, hath God said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden. But of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. And the serpent said unto the woman, you shall not surely die, for God doth know that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. So this confirms that Eve knew the rules, but then it also shows how the false alternative was presented. Satan didn't come with a whole new philosophy of different rights and wrongs and do's and not to do's. What he brought was a perversion of what God taught them. He said, sure, that is part of what God said, but that wasn't accurate. He's missing something. Let's change this a little bit. It's not about not eating that tree. You can do that. This will be the effect, and what God doesn't want that effect to be for you. Completely, Satan completely took what God said and twisted it into a palatable way that was desirous, really, to Adam and Eve. So then number four, after the false was presented, what did they have to do? They had to make a choice. They knew what God said. They heard a twisted, perverted version from Satan, and they had to choose. Follow God or follow my own mind through the influence of Satan, and we see that they chose wrong. Okay, so that makes sense. the basic formula. God taught them. They understood it. Satan came with a perversion of what was supposed to be and not supposed to be. And then Adam and Eve made a choice, and it was the wrong choice. Completely makes sense. How about then with ancient Israel? Does the same general formula apply to them? And it does. So number one, the truth of the law is given in the formula. Well, we know God thundered the Ten Commandments when he spoke to Israel. He thundered them out and said, these are these major rules that you need to follow. Right? And not only that, Moses was taught the statutes and judgments, and he taught them to Israel. So the Ten Commandments and the statutes and the judgments were taught. It was very clearly explained what was expected of Israel. So let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 4 and read verse 1. Deuteronomy 4 and verse 1. Now therefore hearken, O Israel, unto the statutes and unto the judgments which I teach you, for to do them, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the Eternal God of your fathers giveth you. So Israel knew. So Moses was declaring that what God taught him, he was relaying to Israel. They were listening and they heard it. So let's go to verses 5 and 6. Deuteronomy 4, verses 5 and 6. Behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Eternal my God commanded me, that you should do in the land whither you go to possess it. Keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. The command to keep and then to do them first implies that they were taught. You were given them. Now that you are given them, I want you to keep them and do them and don't change. That's the basic rule. So Israel heard it and they understood it and they agreed in principle to follow it. Along the way, though, to get up to this point, signs and wonders were used by God to substantiate him, his law, and who his servants were. So let's think about this a moment, right? They're being taught specific rules to say, you're going to have blessings, you're going to have good things in your lives, follow these things. And it's coming from this God, this being, who has done miraculous things for you, and he's saying, good things will continue if you just stay true to what I taught you. But getting up to this point, what did they see and experience? Well, let's just recap a little bit about the Exodus from Egypt. So number one, though, they saw plagues in Egypt, right? Mighty miracles within Egypt, whether it was water turning to blood, whether it was pestilences, frogs, flies, mites, darkness, things that affected everybody, things that only affected Egypt but not Israel. They saw all those things which were miraculous in themselves. Walking day after day where a pillar of cloud or a pillar of fire went before you to show you the way. I mean, think of that almost like a tornado went away, not causing any damage, but you've got this huge cloud spinning and spinning and spinning, and this is what you're to follow. And you know this is God directing you and leading you the way. That's pretty miraculous in itself right there. And then we get to the parting of the Red Sea. Just those in itself are pretty amazing signs and wonders that God used to substantiate himself and also in part who his servants were. So it's pretty clear that these signs and wonders were used to substantiate God and who his servants were, Moses in particular. Let's read a little bit more about some of the things that had taken place, again, as a reaffirmation of who are God's servants. And we're going to turn to Leviticus chapter 9, and we're going to read some of the instructions that Moses gave to Aaron regarding certain offerings. And we'll start in verse 1, Leviticus chapter 9 and verse 1. And it came to pass on the eighth day that Moses called Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel. Read verses 5 and 6 next. And they brought that which Moses commanded before the tabernacle of the congregation, and all the congregation drew near and stood before the Eternal. And Moses said, "This is the thing which the Eternal commanded that you should do, and the glory of the Lord shall appear unto you." So Moses is there as God's servant. He is explaining these things to the people. They are there, and they're listening, and they're hearing, and they are understanding. Continuing in Leviticus chapter 9, read verses 23 and 24. And Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle of the congregation and came out and blessed the people. So right here is an action that people are seeing. Israel is seeing that these are God's servants acting on his behalf. Okay? So Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle of the congregation and came out and blessed the people. And the glory of the Eternal appeared unto all the people. And there came a fire from before the Eternal and consumed upon the altar the burnt offering and of the fat, which when all the people saw, they shouted and fell on their faces. And amazed them. They weren't expecting that. They reacted because they reacted to seeing something very miraculous. And yes, they were showing respect to God. But what does this demonstrate? What is something we can take out of this point here? Even after seeing the Almighty God perform all of these miracles to substantiate himself and his servants, witnessing these physical things, here is something that they weren't quite expecting. Something miraculous happened. It was fire coming down from heaven, and they reacted and they fell on their faces. It's the human reaction here that we need to see. And the core of that is for all of us to understand that we cannot underestimate the pull, the emotional pull that us as humans have to seeing miraculous things. It's strong. It doesn't matter if we know right versus wrong. It may not necessarily matter what we've seen or not seen in the past, because this is proof right here that as a carnal person, even witnessing time after time after time of God's miracles, something else miraculous can appear and we will automatically react. It's what we're programmed to do. The important thing is to keep that in mind so we can react in the proper way in the future. So let's use and look at a second example of, I'll say, a sign or a miracle, something pretty impressive that God has used to confirm who his servants are. And this is when the priest carried the Ark of the Covenant across the River Jordan. We're going to read Joshua chapter 3. We're going to read verses 9 through 17. And read it all. It's just a wonderful story to read. So Joshua chapter 3, beginning in verse 9. And Joshua said unto the children of Israel, "Come hither and hear the words of the Eternal your God." And Joshua said, "Hereby you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Hivites and the Perizzites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Jebusites." So right there, something's going to happen. A promise is going to be made that you will see come to fruition. It's a guarantee, which goes back to having faith in God. It's a guarantee it'll happen. Continuing in verse 11, "Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Eternal of all the earth passes over before you into Jordan. Now, therefore, take you 12 men out of the tribes of Israel, one out of every tribe, a man. And it shall come to pass, as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests that bear the ark of the Eternal of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of Jordan, that the waters of Jordan shall be cut off from the waters that come down from above, and they shall stand upon a heap." So number one, again, this is confirming that the priests are his servants. They are holding his law through the Ark of the Covenant. They're responsible for that. And this sign or this wonder will confirm it. But it also confirms that something had to be done first. So continuing in verse 14. "And it came to pass, when the people removed from their tents to pass over Jordan, and the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as they that bear the Ark were come under Jordan, and the feet of the priests that bear the Ark were dipped in the brim of the waters, for Jordan overfloweth all his banks at the time of the harvest, that the waters which came down from above stood up and rose upon a heap very far from the city of Adam, that is beside Zaratan. And those that came down towards the sea of the plain, even the salt sea, failed and were cut off, and the people passed over right against Jericho. And the priests that bare the ark of the covenant of the Eternal stood firm on dry ground in the midst of Jordan. And all the Israelites passed over on dry ground until all the people were passed clean over Jordan. And so here's another thing to think about. The Jordan was just not a little creek. It was not a little trickle of a few inches deep that you just had to walk over, and it was no big deal. This was harvest time. The Jordan is a large river to begin with. It was overflowing because of the rage of water that was coming down. So really mentally think of it this way. You've got a really big river in front of you, and it is raging, and the current is strong. And if you just walk out into it, you're going to be swept away. There's no possibility that won't happen. You will be swept away because of the force and strength of the water. So what did the priests have to do? They had to carry the Ark of the Covenant, which was a solemn task, and they had to step into raging waters. But they had to do it first before the miracle took place. They had to act in faith. That must not have been an insignificant sight to see. All of a sudden, a raging river part and stand up, dry ground was available, and everybody passed over. That had to be impressive. Anybody standing on the banks saw that, had to have said, wow, this is amazing, it happened again, here's a parting of the waters, and we are saved, and we are walking and seeing God fulfill his promises. We've seen it time and time again. So this is what's happened. Let's recap so far, right? The truth of the law was given to Israel, and they heard it, and they accepted it, and God used some signs and miracles to substantiate him, his law, and his servants. So we read this and say, okay, that should be enough, shouldn't it? Well, but see, now this is where we get to point number three in the four-point formula. Number three is that a false alternative was going to be presented. So when Israel was in the promised land, was to go in the promised land, nations were around them that had false religions and a way of life and a lifestyle that was an abomination to God. And there was a built-in temptation that Israel would have to learn their ways, and they'll be curious about their ways. But God said he didn't want them to do that, which is why he said stay apart from them and stay separate in very specific ways. So in a way to us, that's like us being told not to entertain Baptist doctrine or Eastern religions. Just don't get mixed up in those outside influences that are so foreign to the faith once delivered that we should completely stay away. And I don't think for anybody here and under the hearing of my voice, that's going to be any kind of temptation. We value God's law and we want to stick to God's law. Some very, very different alternative really is no temptation. But that's not really what the warning is that's coming up. A significant warning is what was going to happen from within Israel. And for that, let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 13. And we will read verses 1 through 3. Deuteronomy 13 and verses 1 through 3. If there arise among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and giveth thee a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder come to pass, where if he spake unto thee, saying, let us go after other gods which thou hast not known, and let us serve them, thou shalt not hearken unto the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams. For the Eternal your God proveth you to know whether you love the Eternal your God with all your heart and with all your soul. So what do we need to know, really, and what is going to be one of our biggest dangers? What is Deuteronomy 13 teaching us here? It's people from within Israel that were presenting a perverted doctrine, some change or twist to what was already given and known. It was a perversion of what Israel heard, understood, and in concept agreed to. So what did Satan do with Adam and Eve? He twisted what God told them. It was a lie, that's for sure, but he twisted what was there just enough to make it enticing. And what is God saying here in Deuteronomy 13? The meaning is that someone's not going to come here with some pagan Babylonian worship of Baal type religion that is so foreign to what Israel was taught, saying, oh, if they show a sign or a wonder, don't follow them. What he is saying really here is that if someone from within Israel and shows a sign or a wonder and is speaking things that are similar to but not exactly what was taught before, you don't follow them. A perversion of the truth, not a wholesale rejection of it. And that is what our danger is. And that is what the Bible really says all throughout and what will happen in the future. And what our main danger is that it's not a wholesale rejection of the truth, but it's a perversion of it. And not to be swayed by some sign or a wonder when it is accompanied by a slight perversion of the truth. That's our main danger. So then point number four of the truth formula, what has to be done? So after a false was presented, a choice has to be made. So what God is saying in Deuteronomy 13 is saying, you have the truth, you know the truth, you were taught the laws, you understand what they are. Now, somebody is going to come with a sign or a wonder, and it's going to happen, right? And you might say this is a pretty miraculous sign or wonder. So when that situation arises, what is your choice? Are you going to reject them or follow what you were taught and what you knew? So Israel had to make a choice. And if we think of Israel as a nation just representing us as people, this is exactly the danger point. You know the truth once the faith once delivered. You know the truth. You love it. You want to abide by it. And here Israel saw all these signs and miracles and things that God was doing for them to substantiate himself and his servants. So something else happens. Someone else from within Israel does similar signs and wonders in some capacity. So do you follow them or not? What's the rule? Do you follow a sign or wonder because you know it has to be from God? Well, not if it contradicts the faith once delivered. So here is Israel with many of them that saw the miracles coming out of Egypt. They saw what happened when Moses was instructing Aaron and the offerings and the fire coming down from heaven. They saw the nation cross over the River Jordan. How many more miracles did they have to see to know that this is a powerful God that says, I will bless you, just follow my rules, and I am doing these signs and miracles to prove who I am. But if something else comes along, you don't follow it, even if that sign or miracle is there. So Israel had to make a choice. Some of them made the good choice, and a lot of them made the wrong choice. And it sounds just like us, doesn't it? So far we have Adam and Eve, and then we have Israel, and the four points were followed. The law was given, it was heard and understood, some sort of false alternative was presented, and then after that a choice had to be made. And along the way, there were some signs and miracles that gave some substantiation one way or the other. Well, how does that continue, or did it just end then and didn't happen again in the future? Well, let's take a look at the apostles and the churches they raised up. So the apostles were taught the truth. They understood it, obviously, right at the feet of Jesus Christ. They were taught that the apostles went out and they raised up churches. They taught the law, number one. Number two, it was heard and understood by the people because churches were raised up in belief. People heard the message, they understood it, and they believed it. So that seems pretty simple. And then a false alternative is presented. And very often, again, it was from within. It's Deuteronomy 13 repeating itself over again. And if you think about it, what were the Apostle Paul's letters to the churches that he established about? It's about remaining faithful, not to accept a perverted doctrine. It's not that they're not accepting something totally new. It's a perversion of what Paul taught them because it had a little twist. It had a little change to it. So how do we confirm this? Let's look at the book of Galatians chapter 1 and read verses 6 through 8. Galatians 1, verses 6 through 8. I marvel that you are so soon removed from him that called you into the grace of Christ unto another gospel, which is not another, but there be some that trouble you and would pervert the gospel of Christ. But though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. So right here, this is proof that is coming from within, because these are individuals that heard the truth, they were taught it by Paul, and some trouble happened from within, and a perverted gospel was being preached. Now, if those individuals didn't have the original doctrine, they couldn't pervert it. It wouldn't be a perversion of the gospel, but it was the true gospel that was being perverted. There was some twist or change to it. And really what the Apostle Paul is saying is, I can't believe this is happening so soon. So soon after I taught this to you, you're accepting something different from someone within, someone that I taught. And Jude repeated the same thing in verse 3. We'll turn to Jude, verse 3. Beloved, when I gave all diligence to write unto you of the common salvation, it was needful for me to write unto you and exhort you that you should earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints. He's saying, it's needful, I have to write to you to remind you and to warn you to keep what you were given. The law, the basics, the specifics that you were given. Something's happening and you're getting a little shaky here. It's needful. I have to write to you to remind you. Don't worry about what else is being preached. Don't worry about what someone else is saying if it's not the basic information that you were taught. I have to write to you. The Apostle Paul did it and Jude did it as well. So for all the members of those churches, what happened after that false was presented? They had to make a choice. Did they keep what they were taught or did they change? The same formula applies. And still at this point in time, signs and wonders were being used by God to substantiate his servants, just like in the past and will be in the future as well. So let's turn to the book of Acts, chapter 6, and we'll read verse 8. Acts chapter 6 and verse 8. And Stephen, full of faith and power, did great wonders and miracles among the people. And it's easy to skim right over that. But Stephen performed what is recorded as great wonders and miracles among the people. And just like the other apostles. So God was allowing these miracles and wonders to take place to substantiate him, God's law, and also who his servants were, so that the people would listen to his true servants. And then shortly after that, Stephen was killed and the Apostle Paul was right there to see the event. Right? So this then sets the stage for something else to happen. And for that, we're going to turn to Acts chapter 8. And this gets to be a little bit of an interesting point because there were other miraculous things happening at that time too. And we don't know the full extent. It's not all recorded there. But what happens when you have competing signs and miracles? Different people performing great things. So who's right? How do you make the choice? How do you make the distinction? Well, let's read verses 1 through 3 in Acts to begin. And Saul was consenting unto his death. And at that time, there was a great persecution against the church, which was at Jerusalem. And they were all scattered abroad throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. And devout men carried Stephen to his burial and made great lamentation over him. As for Saul, he made havoc of the church, entering into every house and hailing men and women, committing them to prison. So there was a time of chaos. There was a time of competing religious views. There was a time of people trying to influence other people of what the right way is. So read verses 4 and 6, 4 through 6. Therefore, they that were scattered abroad went everywhere preaching the word. Then Philip went down to the city of Samaria and preached Christ unto them. And the people with one accord gave heed unto those things which Philip spake, hearing and seeing the miracles which he did. So Philip preached the word. He He showed signs and miracles, and probably a big part of that was by miraculous healings. And there was great joy in the city. It was having a positive effect. People were following and listening and believing. And then let's read verses 8 and 9. But there was a certain man called Simon, which before time in the same city used sorcery and bewitched the people of Samaria, giving out that himself was some great one, to whom they all gave heed from the least to the greatest, saying, "This man is a great power of God." And that's because of the sorcery, the signs and the miracles and the wonders, the miraculous things he was doing. And then in verse 11, and to him they had regard, because out of a long time he had bewitched them with sorceries. So he was able to give some sort of signs and miracles and wonders that the people saw, and it influenced the people, because that's what miraculous things do. And if you have something that sounds good and you have some sort of miraculous visible thing, it's going to influence you. And this is proof right there that it influenced the people. So here you have two different people at the same time preaching words, each showing miraculous things. So how do you make the choice? Because the people thought they were both men of God, but they both weren't. How do you know? Again, it's the doctrine, and that's the priority. It all comes down to the doctrine. So what happened to Simon? Well, let's continue in verses 12 and 13. But when they believed Philip preaching the things concerning the kingdom of God in the name of Jesus Christ, they were baptized, both men and women. Then Simon himself believed also. And when he was baptized, he continued with Philip and wondered, beholding the miracles and signs which were done. So the doctrine convinced him. And after that, even he was impressed by the signs and the miracles that he saw, because they were backed by God and they were used to prove God's law and who his servants were. And so I principally bring this example up here because in concept, something like this very easily, most likely, will happen in the future. And that is different people showing different miracles, preaching different doctrines, people being amazed by each. So who is right? How do you know? And that's the key. So we say, okay, that's great. That all makes sense. This is all through the recorded history in the Bible, and there were signs and wonders, and the law was given, and people made good choices and bad choices. The apostle raised churches up, and people fell away because they were swayed by something else. Great information to know. The formula holds true. Those four parts play out consistently. Does that continue? Well, let's take a look at our parent organization, the Worldwide Church of God, and take a look. So number one, the law of the truth was given. And that comes down to all of us. Do you believe that truth was revealed to Mr. Armstrong as an end time servant? And if you do, he taught us the truth, didn't he? So the truth or the law was given. So then number two, is it heard and understood by the people? Oh, of course, because the truth was powerfully preached and distributed. The Plain Truth Magazine, the good news, the radio, ministers preaching the truth worldwide. People heard it, people understood it, people were baptized, the church grew exponentially decade after decade. There is no question that people heard the truth and were responding to it. So that gets us to point number three, a false alternative being presented. Well, what do we need to be aware of? It's going to come from within. And it did, just like in Deuteronomy 13. Because the warning that was given there played out in our parent organization just like it did in the past. The same signs and miracles didn't take place. Although individually there were different things, the same mighty, visible, miraculous miracles and signs didn't take place. But the people listened to the ministry. The ministry presented a perverted doctrine, principally through the doctrinal committee, saying, hey, we come to new truth and understanding. Yes, we were taught the way, but it wasn't everything correctly, so we're going to make a change. So somebody from within Israel presented a perverted truth to the people, which then gets us to point number four. After that false was presented, people had to make a choice. And people needed to make a choice. Do they stick with the revealed truth, or do they take and accept change? And that change came from servants within the body. Again, it happened with Israel, it happened with the apostles, and it happened in our parent organization. And in fact, it even happened to this very group in the late 1990s, when many ended up departing because they viewed the faith once delivered as different. They had a set of doctrines and beliefs that were different and influenced many. And again, a choice had to be made, and a certain choice was made. So if this formula, if these actions have taken place, really going back from Adam and Eve all the way up into just a few decades ago, do you think it will happen again? Because it looks like there's a pretty consistent formula and way of behavior that takes place all throughout history. And I'll say it does, and this is what we need to be aware of in the future for our spiritual health and growth and strengthening. So this then gets up to the last part in the time period, the days leading up to the return, the literal return of Jesus Christ. The same formula applies, and there will be similar signs and miracles. All the details, we don't know, but there are prophecies that show that those things are going to take place. So let's do a recap of the four parts. What is going to be happening in the last days leading up to the actual return of Jesus Christ? Number one, the law and the truth is going to be given. Some servants will be preaching the truth. And at some point, it'll be miraculous through angels as well. Christ said that he'd be with that body until the very end, and his promise is true. That truth will be preached. Which then means, number two, it's going to be heard and understood by people. They'll hear it, they'll agree to it. People will continue to be called through these last days, and they will continue to accept it. Which also means at some point along the way, a false alternative will be presented. One way or the other, whether that's by organizations that have a version of our truth or some other miraculous ways. And then number four, after the false is presented, a choice will have to be made. That applies not only to new people that are being called, but for everyone under the hearing of my voice, we are going to most likely, if we don't die beforehand, have some false alternative presented to us, and we will need to make a choice to follow it or not to follow it. Will we get swayed by it or not be swayed by it? And you can say, Bob, okay, that's great. I've heard that before in some ways, and it makes sense. I'm not questioning anything that you say. I've passed the test so far, so won't I in the future? And I hope so. And I'm going to go on the assumption that, yes, you will pass it in the future. But I want to bring some concepts up for all of us to think about. And some of these things may happen and some of them won't happen. That's not the important part. The part is, what might happen? How can we think about things a little bit differently to make sure that we really are grounded spiritually? Being aware of these things might make us stronger and better positioned to be faithful for when God does test us, and test us in ways that we don't expect. And that's a very important part, because it all comes down to holding on to the faith once delivered. And that's been repeated over the years, and it'll continue to be repeated. And people that have not taken heed to that in general have discarded it. So it really is important. So what could happen in the future? Well, number one, false ministers, right? And there have always been, there'll continue to be people claiming to be speaking by the authority of Jesus Christ. And just in general, the world can be easily deceived by just about anybody, because it's not their time yet. They're not called. They don't have the ability to understand what God is teaching them in terms of his love. But once he opens their mind, they will know. So again, that's not our real danger. Our real danger is not some completely foreign religion being preached by somebody. Our danger is going to be more of the danger from Deuteronomy 13, which means somebody from an affiliated organization or somebody that is raised up that is preaching something that is very close and similar to what you know and believe and say you love, but there's a twist to it, there's a change to it, and they have some sort of sign or miracle to accompany it. If it's happened before, there's a good chance God's going to use it again. And the point that I want to reemphasize again is don't underestimate your carnal pull to seeing a sign or a miracle. If it happened to Israel, it can happen to you. And what Israel taught us is that the pure carnal reaction is to be swayed by a sign or a miracle. God built it into us. So even though we all know the truth, when we see this sign or a miracle take place, there's going to be an impulse that we have to fight and reject. And then spiritually say, does it contradict the faith once delivered or not? And then we're going to have to make a choice to remain faithful. And if we're aware of that and understand that, we absolutely can do it. And God will give us the ability and the power and the strength to do that. We all can succeed. So we've heard that before, but that's a good reminder. And let's say we pass that. Let's say, oh, I'm not going to listen to somebody, some false minister, if there's a different doctrine. All right. Well, what about the two witnesses? Is that going to be so easy? Knowing who the two witnesses are? Or is there going to be some difficulty in identifying who they are? How do we know? Is there a way in which we can be tripped up by the two witnesses? Because we read it. And we're going to turn there. Revelation chapter 11. We'll start in verse 3. Revelation 11 and verse 3. And I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth. And then verse 6. These have power to shut heaven, that it rain not in the days of their prophecy, and have power over waters to turn them to blood, and to smite the earth with all plagues as often as they will. So I don't know exactly what it's going to be besides what's described here, but they are going to be performing signs and wonders. Miracles, things that will just put us in awe when we see them. And God says, these are my witnesses. I'm confirming who my servants are. So if you see two people performing miracles and is mostly like the truth, does that mean it's the two witnesses? Well, maybe, but maybe not. And the first point I want to bring up, and as we've heard before many times, we cannot be locked into who we think those two witnesses are. And yes, we do think it's a strong possibility that it could be Moses and Elijah because of the description of them in the Transfiguration. And that might absolutely be true. I'm not saying it's not. Why not? Sure. But what I'm advocating is that you don't put blinders on so that you don't hear God's message if it's not them, if it's not who you expect it to be. Because that has happened in the past, right? Did the Jews reject Christ because his message wasn't what they expected it to be? So our danger is not to miss the message of God through his servants because they're not who we think they're supposed to be. Okay, well, how about this? Let's say one of the two witnesses is Moses. Of course, it's got to be Moses. Direct witness. What happens if the second one is Enoch? I mean, Enoch was alive with Adam. He died just not too far after that. He heard the truth. He knew the truth. Could it be Enoch? What happens if there are two individuals, one Moses and one claiming to be Enoch, and they are preaching God's truth? Does that cause any concern? Well, it shouldn't be Enoch. Who's Enoch? Why is he a witness? Well, let's turn to Hebrews chapter 11 and read verse 5. Hebrews 11 and verse 5. By faith, Enoch was translated that he should not see death and was not found, because God had translated him, for before his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God. And then we'll turn to Jude 14 and 15. Jude 14 and 15. And Enoch also, the seventh from Adam, prophesied of these, saying, Behold, the Eternal cometh with 10,000s of his saints, to execute judgment upon all, and to convince all that are ungodly among them of all their ungodly deeds which they have ungodly committed, and of all their hard speeches which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. So Enoch, yeah, he prophesied about the return of Jesus Christ and the judgment to come. Now, what's interesting is that, yes, it says back in Hebrews that Enoch did have God's testimony and he pleased God. And what's an interesting thing about those early writings in the Bible? Very, very few have this written about them as Enoch does, that he pleased God. They're written, they're recorded, we see their lives, we know how old they were, we know what children they had. But go back and take a look. Who else has a descriptor of pleasing God? So you might say, okay, yeah, fine. Well, why are you pulling that? Does that sound like a crazy thought that Enoch could be one of the two witnesses? It's possible, right? Do you think I'm going out of bounds by suggesting that? Am I totally crazy and just bringing something up to be relevant, not relevant? Do you, no, I guess number one is, do you have a problem thinking that one of the two witnesses could be Enoch? What was your initial reaction to say there's some serious merit to it? Or that's just fanciful, it will never happen? Well, the reason I bring that up is because in one of Mr. Cole's sermons, he speculated that Enoch could be one of the two witnesses. He didn't give any explanations, and he wasn't saying that was his favorite, but he did say in a sermon, which I am saying was inspired by God, to float the idea that Enoch could be one of the two witnesses. So does it really matter if it's Enoch or not? Does the name really matter? Whether it's Moses, Elijah, Moses, Enoch, Elijah, Enoch, or somebody else, does it matter? Well, it really shouldn't, because what are we going to know from them? Whoever is there, this group of two people, these two individuals, performing miracles, what are they going to be saying? And does it match exactly with what you know as a faith once delivered? And if that's what matches, that's what matches, the signs and the miracles will just be a substantiation of who they are. It doesn't prove who they are. So then let's say we get past that. What happens if there are false sets of two witnesses? Right? Just as a little bit of a mental exercise, what if you see multiple groups of two individuals claiming to be the two witnesses, claiming to be servants of God, showing some sort of signs and wonders and miracles? Who do you follow? How do you know? Now, it didn't happen in the exact same way, but just recall Simon and Philip. Both were performing miracles and wonders and attracting people, and people followed them, and both thought they were men of God. So if it happened then, could it happen again? Sure, absolutely. Why not? The point is, once again, not going based on our presumptions, not going based on what we narrowly define as who these individuals should be, and following that, but making sure we take a step back and listen. Close your eyes, listen, and hear the message. And then if you see anything on top of that, if that message matches, it'll just be a substantiation. If it doesn't, then think of Deuteronomy 13. Right? Something to prove whether you're going to be faithful or not. And a sign or a miracle will happen, and God is proving you. And he did it to Israel, he did it in the New Testament church, and he's going to do it again. So let's continue now with Galatians chapter 1 and verse 8. I want to get into a little bit about the actual return, the literal return of Jesus Christ, and how that plays into everything we've been talking about today. Galatians chapter 1 and verse 8. But though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. So it doesn't matter who says it. Person, spiritual, angel. Doesn't matter. If the gospel doesn't match, then you discard it. right? Because it all comes down to the message. If you listen to some of Mr. Cole's previous Feast of Trumpets sermons, he's made a statement. He made a statement of those individuals that are called, that value this way of life, that love this way of life, that are looking forward to the return of Jesus Christ and being part of his family. And he's bringing up the concept of not being deceived, because there will be deception in the last days. There will be false ministers. There will be false messages, yes. He also made the statement about not being deceived, even with respect to the little return of Christ. So what does that mean exactly? I don't know the full extent of what he was trying to say, but part of it was saying is that even with respect to the return of Christ, we could be deceived. Just like thinking about the two witnesses and false witnesses. What if there are false appearances of Christ? With the technology that is extant today, with holograms and digital avatars already showing images that are so lifelike in certain conditions that it just amazes people, what if there is something staged, so to speak, that gives the appearance, a watered-down appearance of Christ returning? And what if there's one or two or three, and the actual return of Christ could be number four or five or six or somewhere down the road? Well, what happens, right? If we are so fixed on the return of Jesus Christ because of the description that it brings in the Bible of the shining light coming down, and then there's this miraculous event of somebody coming down claiming to be Christ and preaching the word, and if it's not that real doctrine, what do we say? Are we going to be swayed? Now, that might be a little far-fetched, and I'm just saying this as a mental exercise, whether that happens or not. Same thing like the multiple sets of two witnesses, is make sure that we don't look to or get swayed by the miraculous, because we are hardwired to do that. It can happen automatically. What I'm saying is, regardless of what we see, make sure we pause and listen to the message, and if it doesn't match the faith once delivered, recall Deuteronomy 13, and it's not right. If it matches, then you are on track, and you know it matches. So the whole point of us today, assembling today for the Feast of Tabernacles, is to rehearse the glorious time of when our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ is going to return. And Christ prophesied that deception will happen in the future. There are going to be miraculous things in the future. There will be things that God even allows to happen to test the people, because he did it in the past, and it was enumerated in Deuteronomy 13, and it's happened all throughout history. So if that happens again, we need to be aware of it. We don't want to get caught up in that. So whether someone from without or from within, if a sign or a miracle is shown, don't react to it, but always go back to the faith once delivered. Know those doctrines, believe those doctrines, and if you hold on to those doctrines even to your death, then there's a high likelihood that Jesus Christ will say, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant," and we can inherit eternal life and become part of God's family. And that's what we are after. And again, brethren, God has given you the tools, he's given you the knowledge, and through the power of the Holy Spirit, he's given you the ability to resist, to discern, to know, and to be successful. So may you all have a wonderful rest of trumpets. Great blessings to all of you, and we'll see many of you in the upcoming Feast of Tabernacles.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented The Test Formula, a message by Mr. Robert Burke for the morning service of the Feast of Trumpets, September 16th, 2023.